Let's make sure we're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with our fun verses on how to conduct ourselves when we are not happy, because this usually is not a result of happiness. But we left off there with the Exodus generation in point 11, being an example there. And then while they were certainly one great historical example, point 12 of these behaviors that we're talking about, the grumbling and conflict, God expressed his strong disapproval of their actions with notable judgments. And that was 10 and 11. And he says in verse 11, and this is the important thing, "Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." And so we recognize that this is a, and in verse 12, it clearly is an exhortation to humility. Thinking the one who thinks he stands needs to take heed that he does not fall. Don't be too confident in your own abilities and understanding. Well, 13 here, the use of the plural, murmurings or grumblings, draws attention to grumblings of any kind. This may include complaints about minor irritations, delays, or things over which one really does not have control. And really, how much of that in life? There's a lot of that in life, isn't there, that we don't actually have control over. And that's one of the challenges of being a human being, is that humans want to tend to control things. We like things in their place. Normal humans want things orderly and happen in a regular fashion, and they like routine, and we get used to it. But it may extend here to other members of the congregation, the leadership, or even those on the outside. At a certain point, those on the outside, we just have to say, we have to exercise love toward them, and that just means keeping our mouths shut, not taking our own revenge, not tit for tat and all that, coming back at them with what they do to you, revenge tactics and all that. So there's a lot of things we can't control, and then there's people. You got circumstances and people, either one of which can cause murmuring or grumbling. Because none of us are perfect, none of us are going to be perfect, in fact. So while the Old Testament passages make it plain that the complaints of the Israelites were aimed at God himself, that's Numbers 14, 27 and 29. And God asks the rhetorical question, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me." And then he says, "Here your corpses will fall in the wilderness," verse 29. "Even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you will not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun." Interestingly enough, if you don't know it, the Hebrew term Caleb means dog. It's not necessarily a gracious term. Not sure why. Maybe they thought he was going to be Dog the Bounty Hunter. I don't know why they would name him that. But the point of all of this is that those that grumbled paid the price. And the grumbling and the murmuring and all of that was symptomatic of their unbelief. This is part of what that's expressing. So realistically, let's assume you're a believer. And we believe in an eternal God who's formulated a plan in eternity past before we were even born or brought onto the stage of history. And that he's got everything planned out. And even the details of your life, my life. Well, you know, sometimes I take issue with that and think your plan is not very good. It's not working the way I want it to work. And so in that, we have to be careful. Because we recognize it's just easy to blame God for stuff. But the thing is, and this is the next point here, they gave expression to their dissatisfaction by blaming Moses and Aaron and grumbling against them. Exodus 17:3. Well, let's see, we're in Numbers. Just go 17, number 17:6. We're right there. We'll do these backwards. That's how you get to spiritual maturity. It's backward masking. If you read the verses backwards, they make sense. Moses therefore spoke to the sons of Israel and their leaders and gave him a rod apiece for each. Well, that's not the one I'm wanting, obviously. I guess I got that one wrong. Let's see, where were we? I wonder if that's... Oh, well, let's go to the Exodus. That didn't work. The verses make sense if they're there. Exodus 17:3. This one I'm pretty sure is right. Oh, it was 17:5. I was only off by one verse again. There you go. Now, the nice thing with the tablet up here, I can find it. Well, back to Exodus 17, where we're at there in Exodus 17:3. I guess it's important to get the right book, too. 17:3. But the people thirsted for water. There was no water for the people to drink from verse 1. And they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us from Egypt to kill us?" I mean, this isn't just a little grumbling. I mean, this is all out assault, really. But to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst. And Moses cried out to the Lord. This will drive you to prayer when people attack you. "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." They're going to kill me. You see this? You understand? And so God takes this grumbling, and now back to Numbers where I did have it right. It's 17:5, where he puts them both together in this case. "And it will come about from the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I will lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you." So while this family of words focuses on the general matter of murmuring or complaining, it is evident that God views any grumbling, particularly when it's directed towards the leadership, as grumblings against himself. And this fits with Jesus and his teachings on the chain of command, that it flows from God to his son, to the communicators he chooses, and the people who listen to them listen to Jesus, the people who listen to Jesus listen to God, the people that reject the doctrine as it is because they don't like it for whatever reason, and cramps their lifestyles. The biggest reason most people peel off is it cramps their lifestyle. They want to do something else. The doctrine gets in the way of having to organize your life around Bible class four times a week. That's too much. But they'll figure out something to do. So again, we don't want to be guilty of that, because the chain of command indicates that when you're grumbling against anybody, inevitably you're probably grumbling against God. That you're dissatisfied at some level with how his plan is working out. And certainly he, picks up on this, I would think. Well, 16, when one expresses his displeasure with something or someone related to the local church, it does not promote the unity and harmony that Paul seeks. Rather, it indicates that one is maladjusted. Now, and I'm talking here about non-legitimate things. If there's a legitimate problem in the local church, it needs to be addressed, just like we saw in Acts 6 there. They didn't put it off. They didn't sweep it under the carpet. They addressed it. And their response was really pretty wise. They told them, "Go pick men among yourselves." Well, the seven men they picked all appear to be Hellenists. And so putting the Hellenists in charge of this would serve to diffuse any complaints going forward about their widows and how they weren't getting treated right. So if there's a legitimate issue, that's fine. You can bring it to the leadership. But what we're talking about here is people who sit around and grumble and murmur and complain about stuff, but never lift a finger to fix it. I love one of the things that Dan Brown did years back. Somebody came to him. He's a deacon in charge of, I think, buildings or something there. And somebody said, I saw this over here, this needs to be taken care of. And he goes, "Well, good, why don't you do that? Well, why do you bring it to me? This is something you could handle." But they didn't want to apply. They wanted somebody else to apply. Now, that's the best way to do it, really. You just hope everybody else applies and you don't have to. No, we should be eager and anxious for these things. So again, if there's a legitimate problem coming to the leadership, that we're talking about two different things here. Where a believer is just sitting around crying, whining, and complaining because things aren't going his way in the local church. And the people aren't treating him just with enough deference and all of that. They don't know how special he is. Well, maybe they'll figure it out. Give him time. So 17 here, if one believes that God has a plan for every believer's life. Now, question, first class condition, do we believe this? Is this true? It's easy to say, well, God's got a plan. And here's what I've noticed. Whenever I'm struggling or suffering, people are quick to tell me, well, God's in charge. No, I forgot that. Really? I thought somehow he'd been tossed off the throne up there. And that he no longer ran the universe. No, but when they're under the gun, you don't hear that out of them. Well, now God's in charge. No, that you hear, you know, they're struggling with it. And I'm not talking about necessarily complaining and whining and moaning. Sometimes you express legitimate dissatisfaction. But these are the things that we're talking about here is the non-legitimate stuff. The frustrating circumstances and difficult people. Difficult people? No. That are encountered in daily life must be considered in light of God's will and provision. And when that difficult person's in your face, that's hard to remember right then. When the difficulty's right there on you, it's hard to remember and stop and focus on this. But this is how our mental faculties need to function. We have to, during the difficulty, seek to focus on that which brings us out of those difficulties, that which delivers us from them. Because let's just face it, if I think most of us are smart enough to know that if you sit around whining, grumbling, complaining all the time, nothing suits you and all that, well, you're a pretty unhappy person to start with. Do you feel good when you're that way? Even if you think it's legit, we've all probably done it and felt justified in our minds, well, I have right to complain. Because nobody's got it as difficult as I have. Nobody in the history, this is the worst thing that's happened ever in the history of the world. And God picked me to do it to. Well, first, I bet it's not the worst. Have you been to the cross yet? I think there's some pretty bad stuff out there that God protects us from, fortunately. Well, rather than becoming frustrated, irritated, angry, or exasperated. And it's easy for me to write this stuff because I don't fall into this like some of you do. No, these are passages, as we have said, like anything else. You're not going to get away unscathed, probably. The believer should recognize that God has either allowed these circumstances or even planned them. And that's what you have to focus on. And it's difficult sometimes. The harder the test, the more difficult it is to focus. Or it can be, certainly. Jonah 4, 6-8, we got Jonah as an example here. Jonah, the wayward prophet. I think we can even entitle him Jonah, the angry wayward prophet. So the Lord God appointed a plant, and it grew up over Jonah. Now here's Jonah sitting outside. He's mad already. Jonah's PO'd at God. And he doesn't want to talk to God, and he's hoping like hell that these people didn't really repent, the Ninevites. Because he's waiting. He's sitting outside the city just hoping that God will judge him so he can see it. Now, is that the right attitude? I just hope God judges my enemies so I can see it. Well, no, that's probably not the Christian attitude. And he grew up. He pointed a shade over his head to deliver him from his discomfort. And Jonah was extremely happy about the plan. Hey, I'm that way. When it goes my way, I'm happy. Now I got shade. But God appointed a worm when the dawn came the next day. And it attacked the plant and it withered. And when the sun came up, God appointed a scorching east wind. And the sun beat down on Jonah's head so that he became faint and begged with all his soul to die, saying, death is better to me than life. Again, here's Jonah. When things are going his way, the plant providing the shade, it's all good with God. Then God does something else. And it's important, of course, here you can't miss it, I don't think, that God appoints these things. These things don't happen accidentally. These are part of God's plan for Jonah. And he's going to drive a point home to him here. So Jonah demonstrated the reality that when God does what a person wants, that person is happy. Generally speaking, if you're not happy then, when are you going to be happy? You really must be miserable if you're not happy when it's going your way. And so when God does not do what the person wants, he has the right to act any way he chooses. And so Jonah does. He sits out there and pouts and begs to die. Now, I don't know if you've ever gotten so frustrated that you've asked God to kill you, but I have. And Jonah did. I'm not saying that's a company I necessarily want to be in, but the reality is, yes, I've gotten that frustrated. Why don't you just put an end to this? I clearly am not accomplishing anything here for your plan. What's the point? You just want to torture me? Is that it? And so I've said some things to God I wish I hadn't, that I'm ashamed of now. But in that moment, it's just easy to get that wrapped around the axle. And it can happen to any of us. And the murmuring and our complaining, griping about the driver next to you, turns into road rage next. Then you're in a gunfight. Well, I don't think any of us want any of that. So Paul is a good example of a believer who looked on the bright side of life, not allowing the pressures others sought to place on him to cause him to react inappropriately. We had just seen this in Philippians there, in chapter 1, regarding those believers in Rome who, for whatever reason, had it out for Paul. Who knows why? The former proclaimed Christ out of selfish ambition, rather than pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment, to put mental pressure on me, spiritual pressure. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice. And this isn't, again, just Paul's a Pollyanna and, oh, everything's great. And it's that he makes this conscious choice to not give in to what they're doing, to drag him down to their level. And that's what we do when we allow people to influence us and control us. They live right up here rent-free if you allow them to get to you. So while it may be tempting, point 18, to think or believe that if only life was easier or people were better, I would not have any problem with impatience, frustration, or anger. However, that is simply just not true. Just as pressure and heat are used to refine and purify metals, so God uses the problems and pressures of this life to expose the weaknesses. And that's really what frustrates me as much as anything. I see my weaknesses are being exposed. And sometimes under the sin nature, guess what? I don't want to deal with them. I don't necessarily want to deal with that weakness under the sin nature, but God's going to force me to it. If I really want to grow, if we really want to excel, if we really want to achieve spiritual greatness, it's going to take it. God does a lot of grinding on you. The old grinding wheel here, take this believer. Oh, that took off 3 layers of skin. Well, spiritual skin, that's the point. Took off 3 layers of the sin nature, as it were, of those activities. So he uses the problems to expose the weakness, which must be addressed and eliminated if he is to be pure. Isaiah 48, 10. So if one is shooting here, that's the whole purpose of purifying, is to make something pure. And ultimately, this is the goal. Isaiah 48, 10. Behold, look, pay attention. I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. For my own sake, I will act. For how can my name be profaned? And my glory I will not give to another. But Daniel also, Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11:35. And the previous context here, in fact, dealt with this Jewish leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, or not Jewish leader, Hellenistic leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, who came up through the Seleucid dynasty. And the Seleucids were a part. Seleucus was one of the divisions of Alexander's kingdom. It went to Ptolemy, Seleucus, I believe Cassander and somebody else. I can't remember who the other one was. And that's a subject of prophecy in Daniel 2 about the kingdom being divided to the four winds of heaven. And then under this Hellenistic leader, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, forced Hellenization was occurring. That the Jews were being forced to conform to Hellenistic standards and lifestyles. So some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time. Because it is still to come at the appointed time. And so some of them, the Maccabees, this is their period in history. If you're not familiar with them, you can read a little bit about them, get a little bit of background. They stood up against this. They stood up for their Jewishness as the people of God. Also 12:10, same book there, Daniel. Many will be purged, purified, and refined. But the wicked will act wickedly. You look at this world and their moral compass. They don't have one. The wicked are going to do wickedly. That's all they want to do. That's all they can do, absent some intervention on God's behalf, on His part to save them. And none of the wicked will understand. Here we are living at the very end of history, and people act like this is just going to continue on. Ad infinitum, hey, there's no problem with this. We got our 2050 plan here for Sarasota. And we're planning way ahead into the future. And I don't know if anybody's noticed, but Putin means business. And rhetoric isn't stopping him. Oh, I didn't ever think it was going to. But again, if we are seeing the fulfillment of this being set in motion, of the bear devouring much flesh, it's about to get a lot worse. And chemical, biological, limited nuclear weapons, don't be shocked. Because I don't think he's got the compunction not to use these things. I think he feels justified in whatever he does. And the more that NATO and the West seek to isolate him, only makes him madder and more determined. You know, like you backed this bull or this, well, let's just say you backed a bear into a corner. And we've been over there kicking sand in his face for a while, trying to ring him about with NATO. And he doesn't care for it and is not going to care for it. So, again, we're going to see a lot of death probably out of this. And people are shocked. And I love, you know, you got to love the United Nations, really. These people sit around and wring their hands and whine and moan and talk about war crimes. And this. I don't know that much about war. But I'm pretty sure the goal of war is to kill your enemy. And you say, well, yeah, but you just kill soldiers. You don't kill civilians. Really? Maybe Rome didn't know about this, or Nineveh, or many of the ancient cultures of history, because this was done all the time. This is what war is. And the innocent suffer in war. But it doesn't make them guilty, it just means they suffer in it. And whether God's judging them or disciplining them, I'm not in a position to say. Who knows? I wouldn't even comment on that. But the fact is, if there are Christians over there, God's working in them. If they're amenable to it. And all of that. So, but those who have insight, they'll see all this coming to pass. They'll understand what's happening. Most will not. The world at large doesn't see what's about to happen to it. They're just oblivious. While they're saying peace and security, then sudden destruction comes on them. There, and then Philippians 2:15, that's ours, that he is going to purify us. He wants us to be pure. And then B, God certainly can use these pressures as a means of producing spiritual growth. If the believer orients to various tribulations, then grace and positive growth will be manifested in his character. The problem is, under the sin nature, we don't always want to orient to it. That's the big issue. Romans chapter 5, which again, Paul's constantly going too far with this stuff. It's nice that we have peace with God. That's wonderful. We're all for that. And it's nice that we have faith and grace in which we stand. And it's nice that we jump up and down in hope of the glory of God. But it's not nice that he wants us to jump up and down about our tribulations, our pressures. Knowing here that tribulation And this is the ellipsis, I'm pretty sure. Tribulation produces patience. But that's if that's not true in the full sense. It produces patience in the one that orients to it. Pressures and testings and all of that, yeah, it's the ellipsis. We rejoice in our pressures and testings, do we? Not most of the time. I don't find myself doing it. But again, this is what we're shooting for. This is the ideal, that we look at things and see them the way God sees them. And not just from our own very limited point of view that has very limited knowledge. And we, do we know what God is doing? As Nebuchadnezzar said after his recovery, once he became a believer, who can ward his hand off? In other words, if God determines to do something, how are you going to stop him? You're not. You're not going to stop him. But here, if you orient to these things, we find out that our tribulations, the bad things that happen, what we would deem to be bad, are in fact for our own good. Because this produces patience, the ability to hang in there. And I'm pretty sure in this case, again, I didn't look at it, but I suspect it's hupomone. Yeah, it is. Patience with regard specifically to our circumstances. There's another term for patience with regard to people, macrothumia. To be long, to be angered, means you don't get angered quickly. People don't get under your skin. Anybody get under your skin? Yeah, we all probably have people like that. But if we orient to them, then positive growth comes. And then you have patience, and patience brings about proven character. And proven character, even greater hope for the future. And our hope is that as we orient to God and His plan, that He will bless us and that this will be reflected in our eternal package. So 19, the believer should also recognize that when he expresses his irritation with people or other circumstances, there may be, you know, I probably should have said there is, but there, we'll stick with maybe here, but a lot of times, why does something get under your skin? Why does something get under my skin? And the answer is because we have the same thing working in us, maybe not in the exact same way, but we have that same weakness. And that's one of the ways God gets us to recognize it. He'll put somebody in your face that's a little bit like you. And they'll, not every test is this way, obviously. We have people that are completely unlike us that still get under our skin. But the fact is, there's probably something in the sin nature that you've got that pokes, for lack of that provokes. So, when people act like they know everything, it irritates those of us who do. When people want their way, it irritates me because I want my way. I don't want your way. And that's what selfishness and self-centeredness of the sin nature is all about. And so why do these things irritate us? Well, James 4, rather, 1 through 3. What is the source? Where do quarrels and conflicts among believers come from? And James asks a question, but he also provides the answer. This is a nice way of telling them. But he phrases it in the form of a question. Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? The only reason we have conflict is we don't get our way. There's something we want. And there's something other people want. And when these two things come into conflict, boom, you've got conflict. Conflict erupts. You lust and you do not have. And he traces this back to their own mental attitude, desires for things. And lust isn't here just sexual lust. You wouldn't limit it to that. It's lust for anything. Power, authority, privilege, money, whatever it is people lust after. Fame, fortune, all this. You lust and you do not have. So you commit murder. You kill somebody to get what you want. You are envious and you cannot obtain it. So you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. See, two fundamental problems he points out. One, they're not taking these issues to the Lord. Who do you think he's talking about asking this for? That when you're lacking something you want, who should you go to first? I think the Lord. And you ask and do not receive because you ask with the wrong motives. Some people pray. Oh, I'm sure there are people out there every week who pray to win the lottery. But what's their motive in winning the lottery? So they'll get rich. So their problems, quote, in this life will be over. If you win enough millions, you'll be exempt from the problems of history. That's just not true in the first place. That's a very short-sighted view of the world. But they ask with the wrong motives. They want it for themselves, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. Now, if I got money, first I'd give money to the church. But really, I'd get a yacht, a vacation home. You'd spend it far more on yourself than you would ever on the church, most likely. But this is the point. The motivation is selfish. And this is why people don't get what they want from God, because they're selfish. And God doesn't honor selfishness. He wants us to be selfless. So, A, pride may be one of the causes for grumbling and complaining about others and what they do. The root problem may be the belief that one is superior to all others. Well, let's all do our superior dance. We all get up and do it together. We'll all be the church lady. And and this is an easy thing to fall into. I've got doctrine. I'm oriented to God. I've got this. And these people out here, they're all just nut jobs. Well, while that may be true, the underlying attitude is still wrong on my part. What do I have that God didn't bless me with? Paul asked the Corinthians, what do you have that you didn't receive? God blesses you with this stuff. He's talking about in terms of doctrine, but that's true too. So the belief may be, the underlying belief, is that one is superior to all others. And I would never engage in irritating actions like being bad at my job, driving poorly, forgetting things, being late. Well, that's other people. That's not me. I'd never do this. I've couple 32 years here. Now it'd be 33 this year. I've gotten to Bible class twice without my materials. And not perfect. Still make mistakes. It'd be nice not to make anyone. Yeah, I'd like to be perfect. Then I could say, nope, problem's you. Has to be. I'm perfect. But even though Jesus was perfect, you never saw him act that way. And certainly he could have lorded it over anybody in every possible way. Luke 18:10, two men went up to the temple to pray, a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood praying this with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other people. These people do irritating things. They're evil. They're sinful. Oh my God. But thank you, I'm different. I'm above all this. Well, that isn't looking down his nose much. Oh, that's all it is. I'm not swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. And that was a slur at that time, sinners and tax collectors. So this can certainly be addressed by recognizing that one should not take... What? I don't know where this line came from. One should not take oneself so seriously. Enlighten up. The world will not end because a believer did not get his way. Sometimes we think it might, I guess. We act like it might. But it won't. And again, the challenge of this is because this is all ongoing. And we can sit here in Bible class today and say, yep, I see this clearly. I'm never going to grumble again. And then on the way home, before you get out of the parking lot, who knows? Something can hit you. And you find out how quick this is. I mean, I don't know if you notice this about your sins. The ones that are easy, like verbal sins. How easy it is to just fall into it without thinking. Without even stopping, think about what you're saying. Because you're irritated. You're upset. You're out of sorts. And probably out of fellowship. So one reason, again, people get frustrated and irritated when something interferes with their plans or their schedule is that they often focus on how it affects them. After all, they are the center of the universe and do not have to consider the views or interests of others. Unfortunately, what did we just study? And again, all of this hits us right where we live. It's the matter of putting others first and not wanting my own way. And again, sounds all fine and good here in class. But then we have to go out and deal with this in the real bad world. So Paul makes it plain in this letter that this focus can be changed in the mental attitude. One can choose to focus on the needs and interests of others rather than focusing only on how things affect him. That's the verses we just covered there in Philippians chapter 2. right at the beginning there. I make my joy complete by choosing. Again, these are volitional choices. By choosing to be of the same mind. By choosing to maintain the same love. By choosing to remain united in spirit. By choosing to remain intent on one purpose. By not choosing to be selfish or empty conceit. But choosing humility and regarding one another as more important than yourselves. So one author noted that people often set themselves up for frustration and failure because of their focus on their own agenda and their timing, which may not allow for the unplanned events or circumstances that God has planned. This is one of the problems as we recognize as human beings, that our knowledge is limited. We see through a glass darkly. We don't get the whole picture. But God does. And He also knows what's coming. We don't. Now we can plan ahead. For instance, I plan on leaving home at the same time every Tuesday and Wednesday to get to Bible class on time. Same things on Sunday. But I've left home at the right time and made Bible class 100 times, but then there's that one time I don't. Because something happens on the interstate, there's a wreck, things get closed down, whatever it was. I think I left one time and was late because I, slightly late, wasn't very, more than a minute or two, but second I pulled out of my driveway, I get a note call from the thing, my alarm's going off, which I had to turn around, go back and turn it off. So things happen that we don't plan. No matter how well we plan, God has a way of throwing a curveball at you every once in a while, just to keep you on your feet, if nothing else. And He doesn't always do what we want. Here, while planning is an essential aspect of human life, we are not encouraging you not to plan. That's not what we're saying. But what we are saying is that our plans have to be submitted to God. And every one of our plans has to be, He's got a line item veto. So we may have 15 plans. Well, He may go through and check, nope, nope, nope. And the other ones may be fine with God's plan. They are working out God's will in that regard. So while it is an essential aspect, the believer must remain flexible. What? No. I think rigid is the way to go here. Rigidly insist on getting your own way and accomplishing your own agenda. That's what gets us into trouble. Be rigid with God. Well, God knows how to break anybody that's rigid. We've seen it. We've got history of it. So you must remain flexible with regard to His plans, knowing that God may have a different, better plan. Well, He couldn't have a better plan than I have. Where does God come off? Certainly, I know what's best for me, right? No, deep down we don't. That's the issue. That's one of the issues. Oh, crud. Oh, that didn't work either. Well, if I could type, it would be helpful. Let's try this. There you go. See, I knew I could find it. Just give me long enough. The mind of a man plans his way. Proverbs 16:9. I should have put that in here. I don't know why I didn't, because it occurred to me here. The mind of a man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. And of course, this is a great comfort to the adjusted believer. When we're adjusting to God, we can say, well, I can make my plans, but I got to believe that God's in this. I don't make plans that I know just conflict with God's will. That'd be stupid. If I do that, I deserve what I get. Making plans that I know conflicts with God's will. That's not a wise way to go. We've all done it, I'm sure. I can't remember anything I did. Apparently, last May, signing that contract for remodeling. I thought God was leading me in that. Boy. And He may have been. See, and this is another thing that we tend to do. I do, I know. And that is, if anything goes wrong, then God wasn't in it. Well, no, that's not make it true. God could be in it and things could go wrong. And then we have to learn how to deal with it when things go wrong. And don't assume, my God, why have you forsaken me? I've been betrayed. And, like old Jim Jones. Again, God may have a different, better plan. But again, that's part of human arrogance. How can anybody have a better plan than me? Because I know best for me, right? Well, that tends to be what people think. Well, B, what the believer can understand is that no matter how things unfold in life, God is using the events and circumstances of life for the believer's ultimate good, which is, by the way, conformity to His Son. It's not our good, quote, just here in time. God takes care of us. There's no doubt. At the end of Romans there, He goes into great detail about that. But Romans 8, 28 and 29... And we know that God causes all things to work together for good. Now, He doesn't define what good is. We have a general sense of two things, good and bad. And things that fall under those two broad categories. But He doesn't define what the good is here yet. To those who love God. To those who are called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew. He predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, so that He would be the firstborn among many brethren. And that's the very best thing God can do for anybody, is conform them to the image of His Son. He is the premier example of everything. He is the man par excellence. He is the man above all men. He shows what being a man should be like, what God expects of a man. And it's not standing around tossing off orders, shouting for your will to be done. Although that's a fun way to do. But that's not what God wants. We don't see Jesus engaging in that behavior. We see He was careful. He was cautious. He was kind. We see that He put up with all manner of nonsense. How many times would you have wanted to wring Peter's neck in 3 years, you think? I bet more than once. And yet He knew that these men had it within them to change the world. That He had a plan for them and He knew what they would fulfill. But they had to outgrow their stuff too. It's not like the disciples didn't go through all these same things we go through. To grind them down, to get them polished, to get them where He wants them, to refine them, to purify them. And that's that. So here, the coal, conform us to the image of His Son. That's the good. That's the best He can do for anybody. That you would be like Christ and manifest that glory, those virtues, all that He is. And that's why we're learning a person. We're not just learning principles of the truth and doctrine. We are learning that. But this is all about a person. The goal of all of this, the end of all of it. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He is the author and perfecter of faith. And so we see the way He lived. Well, that's kind of what we're shooting for. Now, obviously, that's a big, high standard. I'll admit it. It is. In fact, the standard is perfection. We'll never attain that. We know that. But that doesn't mean we don't quit shooting for it. We keep shooting for it. Well, the second term is also found in the plural. The noun dialogismos, opinion, first means to a reason through, to have an opinion, is a compound that deals first with the reasoning process and then with the content or conclusions that one reaches by means of his thought processes. It involves thinking through things. That the dia, generally, that preposition, has a lot of times the idea of through something. It's used certainly in that way frequently in the scriptures. Well, this word, point 22, has a wide range of meanings that include the process of reasoning or thinking through things. It is used also of evil thoughts in general and anxious doubts. Matthew 15, 19. Here, talking about the root of all of this, the unregenerate heart. And the heart in this context has to do with the old sin nature. But obviously, even the unbeliever has to give the go-ahead to these things. He has to actually act them out and do them. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders. These are the things that defile the man. To eat with unwashed hands, that doesn't defile the man. Not in a religious sense. Now again, for purely hygienic reasons, of course, wash your hands. But we're not talking about hygiene here. We're talking about people believing that washing somehow makes you right with God. That's tantamount to those people that believe they're saved because they're baptized. Not saved because you're baptized. Here, you're not unclean because you eat with unwashed hands. You're unclean because of what comes out of your own soul. What comes out of the old sin nature that you don't check? And all unbelievers, of course, do this. We seek to avoid them if we can. And then anxious doubts, that's Luke 24:38. So, again, all the... Here is when he appears to them, and of course they're dumbfounded, they're shocked, scared even. He tells them, he asks them, why are you troubled here? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? Doubts here is the dialogismos. So additionally, it can mean the verbal exchanges that take place when conflicting ideas are expressed. In that case, it has the sense of an argument or dispute. Which is how it is to be understood here. Luke chapter 9, verse 46. And an argument. And here they just translated dialogismos as the term argument. And an argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. I wonder how many times Jesus put up with this argument. They were doing it the night he was headed to crucifixion. The night of his arrest, they were arguing about who was the greatest still. And that's why none of them would get up and wash the feet of anybody else. Jesus did it there in the upper room, John chapter 13. But they are arguing about who's the greatest, who's the best. I'm going to be higher in the kingdom than you are. Well, that's not the issue. And so 24, although he uses different vocabulary, James addresses similar types of behaviors and clearly indicates that these types of verbal problems are indicative of one or both believers leading with the old sin nature. We just actually had seen that, but why? Where do these things come from? He doesn't use the same language. He uses polemos here, quarrels, warfares, fights. And conflicts, make, has to do with an individual battle. And so you have these individual battles and these wars. Where do they come from among believers? Well, they come out of the source of your pleasures. That one or both believers wants their own way under the sin nature, and boom, you've got a conflict. And that's always going to happen when you have conflicting ideas and conflicting thoughts, conflicting viewpoints, conflicting desires. Well, Paul uses the same term with the noun orge, anger or wrath, to indicate that this type of dissension is sometimes, and probably often, connected with the matter, that should be matter, not manger, the matter of anger. I was thinking it was Christmas, it's just Easter. 1 Timothy 2:8. Therefore, I want men in every place to pray, lifting up hands without wrath and dissension, disputing, debating. But again, this matter of unity is what will solve all this. How do you keep from having these warfares? You're unified in spirit. You're headed the same direction. Okay, well, we're going to stop there today and get you out of here. We will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to study these things. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our betterment and growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.